You heard it here. Welcome in to another Saturday edition of Calvin and Campbell here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Another loaded Saturday of some excellent sports content. A long week that was. And Calvin, it's been way too long. How are you feeling this morning?
I'm feeling good. It was interesting because for some reason this morning, it was really tough to get out of bed. I don't know what it was. Like, I usually get up in the mornings pretty easily. But something about this Saturday morning, it's cold outside, there was snow this week. Like, I felt like sleeping in on a Saturday, but no.
Some slight snow this week.
I'm here for sports at 9 a.m. on a Saturday on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
That's the attitude I like to hear. A lot that's happened in sports this week, but we wanted to start off with something that is actually happening today, or what today is.
My favorite movie.
Your favorite movie. One of the greatest upset in the history of sports has made for, like you said, a great movie starring Kurt Russell.
Maybe, I mean, really just in terms of history, I think this even is a big moment. Obviously not like an American Revolution or Great Depression, but this is something that is a landmark event in the tensions between two countries.
And it's arguably one of the most important events that had happened that, I guess, wasn't political in the Cold War. In terms of politics in the Cold War, it was one of the greatest happenings, and that is the Miracle on Ice. And today is the 40th anniversary of what I consider, I'm sure everybody else on planet Earth would consider, the greatest upset in the history of sports. A bunch of college kids beating a Soviet Union team that beat the NHL All-Stars, less than a year before that?
Like 9-1.
Like 9-1.
Wasn't even close.
I mean, just waxed them. Absolutely waxed them. And then, like, a couple weeks before the Olympics, waxed that same Team USA team, 12-2?
Yes, might have been the something score. Awful.
I can't remember if that was it, but it was almost a 10-goal deficit. And then the semifinal game, the Team USA, a bunch of college kids, mind you. Kids younger than me and you.
Younger than us, our age.
Yeah.
Up in Lake Placid, New York, did something crazy. Captain Kurt, actually the professional producer
he is,
has audio of the call. Captain Kurt, give it to us.
Now Petrov controls. Back to Varlamov. Skating in on the left side. Into the American end. 55 seconds, but Mikhailov has the puck. Mikhailov sweeping in. Out in front. Backhander goes wide. I think Craig might have got just a piece of it. Mikhailov. That got the Vilya Legendov. 43 seconds remaining. Morrow checked into the boards. It comes back to center ice. 38, 37 seconds left in the game. Petrov with it. The Americans on top, 4-3. Long shot. Craig able to get a piece of it to sweep it away. 28 seconds. The crowd going insane. Karlamov shooting it into the American end again. Morrow is back there. Now Johnson, 19 seconds. Johnson over to Ramsey. Vilya Legendov gets checked by Ramsey. McClanahan is there. The puck is still loose. 11 seconds. You've got 10 seconds. The countdown going on right now. Morrow up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game. Do you believe in miracles? Yes! Unbelievable.
Man, that doesn't give you chills. I don't know what will. You don't have a pulse if that doesn't give you chills.
Communism was defeated right then and there.
Oh, man. Every time I hear Al Michaels go, do you believe in miracles?
Oh, man.
That might be the greatest upset and the greatest sports call of all time. Al Michaels, instant legend for that alone. And, of course, obviously goes on to have a legendary broadcasting career. But that's still his defining moment.
Even though I was 18 years away from being born during that, I still hear that and just all I want to do is somehow be able to live in that moment when that happened. The terrible audio quality that we have the luxury of being able to hear things in crystal clear quality today. Go back to that day in a non-HD TV or something on the radio.
Looks like it was recorded with a toaster.
Yes. And just experience what this event was like to see this completely random event happening that, like me, not someone who believes in momentum or anything like that, but this group of kids from the Northeast in Minnesota, led by a college hockey head coach, go out and do the unthinkable. I wish I was old enough to be able to have lived through that one moment, because if I could go back to any sports moment in time, my answer is almost always the Miracle on Ice.
And I know from people that, obviously, people like my dad, for instance, he's not a big hockey guy. He never has been. He's loosely kept up with the NHL throughout his life. Like, he maybe watched the Stanley Cup Finals once every 10 years or so. Isn't a big hockey guy, but was watching that game. He was watching that game and knew exactly how big of an underdog they were. And he still would tell me as a kid how important that game was because of everything that was going on with the Cold War. And they were such big underdogs, too, when Soviet Union was such a powerhouse that hockey become their sport. They dominated the Olympics. This was the best team on planet Earth and the best team that planet Earth has ever seen. And the Americans knocked them off before they could even get to the gold medal game. Absolutely incredible. And this is not something we will never, ever see again.
No.
I don't think that can't be recreated.
No, because well, obviously professionals being allowed in the Olympics now. Mm-hmm. And just when you watch the 30 for 30, we've talked about it, of Miracles of Men ESPN, that is a great story at the Soviet side of it all and everything those guys were going through. And his name just slips my mind, the one who came to the NHL first from that team as a defenseman.
Gorbachev, was it?
I think so.
No,
maybe. Gorbachev?
No, I think, I probably botched that.
I don't think it was Gorbachev, but...
So many Cold War characters have blended into my memory, but this team was a machine, an absolute machine.
So you get to walk through all the political tensions, but everything going on with them actually being part of the military as Olympic athletes and all these other things going on. And you mentioned your dad not being a big hockey fan. Like, my mom grew up in Georgia. Like, they don't play hockey in Georgia, but she was watching the Miracle on Ice. My dad, they didn't care about hockey in Nashville when he was coming up, but he watched that because it was this monumental event.
It's one of those things that define not only the country at the time, but the world. It didn't just shock this country, but the entire world. And today being the 40th anniversary of it is pretty darn cool, and it's something to be celebrated. And I might just watch the movie Miracle later on today.
Oh, I'm definitely going to watch the movie Miracle.
You bring up an interesting point, both of you, when you said that your parents watched it and they didn't know who won. That game was tape delayed.
Man.
But a majority a majority of the country did not know that they had won that game.
That's incredible.
Because, we're in social media hell or heaven.
Whatever you want to define it.
It's instantaneous now. But, as monumental as that was, very few people knew that. The only people that saw it live were the people in that
arena. Where did you watch it? Or did you watch it?
I did watch it. Oh. I was in Pensacola, Florida at a training.
They really don't play hockey in Florida.
No, they don't. It's hard to play on sand.
Hard to.
And that's the way it was. I think we had heard on the radio or something that they had upset the Russians, and so we watched it. A bunch of guys that I was training with, and
What was your initial reaction, Kurt, to hearing that?
To the final call?
To the final call.
Oh, it gave me goosebumps. Then it gives me goosebumps now.
Goodness, that. Again, if I could go back to any one moment in sports history, it is the Miracle on Ice. Absolutely, no doubt.
Yeah. Oh, I think so. Just because the improbability, B, the implications of what was going on in the world at that time. It's just the perfect storm of sports being more than just a game. That was more than just a game. You can't tell anyone that was on that 1980s U.S. Olympic hockey team that they were just playing a game in that moment. It meant more than that, and that's what makes sports so great.
Yeah, it was not Mikhail Gorbachev.
That was the Mikhail
Gorbachev, the former Soviet politician, eighth and last leader of the Soviet Union.
He was the last one. Yeah, that was the guy who Reagan told to tear down his wall.
Yes.
Okay.
So he was not a defenseman on the team.
100% was. If he was, then that's one of the most impressive resumes.
That's
of
a well-rounded man.
That would be the most well-rounded man, and that'd be even more impressive that not only did you beat this stacked Soviet Union hockey team, you defeated one of their last leaders on the ice when it mattered.
Just everything about that game. I mean, obviously I know it a lot through the movie Miracle, of course, but I've also done a good bit of reading on it. But just the whole thing with Mike Ruzzioni, and they're doing again,
man.
They just keep skating up and down
that
the ice.
Scene,
and
they get waxed by, who was it?
I think it was Norway.
Norway.
And I've heard that scene has been embellished a little bit, just like the fight between Jack O'Callaghan and, was it Mark Johnson?
Mark Johnson.
Mm-hmm. That fight, that didn't really happen. And I've heard, obviously, in the movie there's been some embellishment and things like that.
Hollywood embellishment, yeah,
of course, naturally. And that's what makes it such a good movie.
Exactly.
But who do you play for? And like none of them say the right answer, and they just keep skating up and down the ice. Mike Ruzzioni, Boston, Massachusetts. Who do you play for? I play for the United States of America. Ugh!
That's one of the best scenes of that movie. Obviously, when they beat Soviet Union is the
but that turning that turning
movie.
Point, that crux where you mm-hmm. feel it, that they come together as a unit and the lines start playing together well.
Yeah. Oh. They have that ultimate come to Jesus moment after losing to a bad Norway team.
Yes.
Herb Brooks, one of the greatest motivators in all of sports.
Kurt Russell did such a good job.
Oh, an excellent job. Yeah. Kurt Russell, I think, is a fantastic actor, but that might be his best movie, in my opinion, just because he was able to capture the essence of what Herb Brooks was as a coach and a motivator. We talk about motivators in sports being the guys like Vince Lombardi, Newt Rockne, you know, all of these, so many like legendary names that we can associate with, even Phil Jackson, even. This guy might have been like the greatest motivator because you don't just beat a team like the Soviet Union with X's and O's. You don't. Especially with a team of a bunch of college kids who, like we mentioned earlier, lost 10 goals or so, by 10 goals or so, to this Soviet Union team. It takes being able to get inside the heads of these kids and get them to play as a unit and play for their country in a time where that was more important than ever. And I think it does. I don't want to say it gets overlooked. It does. It doesn't. But I think it should be talked about more when you talk about the this game and the memory of this game was Herb Brooks getting these guys ready to play. And they're showing on ESPN right now on the bottom ticker. They have like the Miracle on Ice. They're giving up stats from that game.
Yep.
Another crazy thing from this game that I just realized was that the Soviet Union outshot United States 39-16.
I saw like someone went back and did the Corsi numbers on it. The Corsi stats were so wildly in favor of the Soviet Union. I think it was like the U.S. had 31% Corsi.
Oh my God!
There is no way the United States should have won this game by any
metric.
They
barely had possession.
It is completely random that they won. But guess what? Sometimes when there's a 99% chance you'll lose, the 1% happens.
And so you could have played these guys 500 times and you only beat them once. But that one time it happens, that one time that probability gets turned on its head, just so have me turned on its head at the greatest moment in American history.
It's let's end this segment on this quote, the famous speech from Herb Brooks in the locker
room. Give this to me.
Great moments are born from great opportunity. And that's what you have here tonight, boys. That's what you've earned here tonight. One game. If we played them 10 times, they might win 9, but not tonight. Tonight, we skate with them. Tonight, we stay with them, and we shut them down because we can. Tonight, we are the greatest hockey team in the world.
He was right. He was absolutely right. And speaking of being right, Floyd Reese, a man who has been right about football a lot.
A lot.
The GM around these parts might have taken our side on something. Something that we kind of consider ourselves to be on an island about.
Strong minority.
A strong minority. And Floyd Reese has kind of sided with us indirectly. We'll find out what that is here on the other side. You're listening to Calvin and Campbell on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
You may be right.
Always am.
I may be crazy.
Always am. Don't you forget it. You're listening to Calvin Campbell here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. And speaking of being crazy and being a lunatic, a lot of people probably think that when they listen to our kickoff coverage during Titan season, we talk about maybe not wanting to pay Derrick Henry the big bucks.
Yeah, I'll stand up and just come out and say it right now. Paying running backs, including Derrick Henry, even though he is a fantastically talented runner of the football, and I have much respect for Derrick Henry's physical conditioning, speed, size, strength combo.
It's freakish athletic ability. We get it.
Paying running backs in the NFL is a fool's bet.
Yeah, and it's proven to be so.
Unless you're getting him for like a 2-year deal for very little money, in my mind, it's not worth it. And that is not a slight against Derrick Henry. I don't like to come on the radio and say that about somebody. But it's a business at the end of the day. And if the Titans are in the business of getting the most out of their roster for the long term and the short term, a running back cannot take up $14 million on your cap like Derrick Henry will.
There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that will agree with the position that we've taken.
And quantitative evidence.
Yeah, quantitative and anecdotal evidence that tell you that you should have your reservations about throwing the bank at Derrick Henry despite how good he was last year. And a caller on Jared and the GM earlier this week asked Floyd about the Titans' offseason situation, and here's Floyd's take on that question.
Mark, on the text line, GM, if you could keep one player, who would it be, Tannehill, Henry, or Jack Conklin?
Wow. I mean, you got to always go with the quarterback.
Yeah, that's too easy. Henry or Conklin?
I'd have to think about that one a little bit. Conklin would be harder to replace.
And you're probably going to, if you sign Conklin, you'll probably have Conklin for longer than you'll have Henry.
And yeah, but Henry means so much from a personality standpoint, but probably Conklin, yeah.
Wow, probably Conklin. And that's kind of what we've been talking about, the relationship between offensive line success and running back success.
So we're not coming on here and saying Floyd Reese is saying don't sign Derrick Henry. We're not putting words in Floyd Reese's mouth. What we are saying is that maybe there's some credence to what we're saying, that running backs in today's NFL are more dependent, and maybe this has been true forever, we just didn't know it, that running backs are more dependent on their offensive line than quarterbacks are.
Yep.
And that their success is more dependent on what's going on in front of them. And You heard Floyd say it. Henry might be more easily replaceable. That's kind of like the joke mantra around football analytics Twitter is running backs don't matter. Well, maybe not to that extent that they don't matter.
They don't matter in general, but
that's not true. Probably not true. But what that statement is saying is that the production you get from a running back is likely more replaceable than any other position given the dependency of the position on what's going on around them, on the passing game around them, on the offensive line in front of them. And that's not to say that passing the football in the NFL is this ultimate, like, Pareto dominant card, that passing is not dependent on anything else, or that play action doesn't matter, or that the running game doesn't help an offense, because it does. It does, it does, it does help. It all helps. But when it comes down to it at the end of the game, wins, sustained success, is much more strongly correlated and related to an efficient passing game than it is a lot of rushes or a lot of rushing yards or a bunch of big runs. Because what do you consider a good average yards per pass attempt, Elijah?
Per attempt?
Yeah, just throw a number out there.
Let's go 6.5.
6.5? And then give me a good rushing yards per attempt.
4.5. So you can
4.5, 2 yards even. And yeah. Let's say, is it fair to say an offense, they'll run the ball 300 times in a season?
Rarely.
I think
in one player. Yeah, I'm thinking Derek, of one player because Derrick Henry by himself.
Derrick Henry did 300
times
in one season. So if you're averaging 2 yards less per rushing attempt than pass attempts.
Don't make me do this math on myself.
We said 2 yards, 300 carries, 600 yards. You've lost 600 yards by running the football.
Yeah, theoretically speaking, yeah.
Now, granted, there's some give and take there between the supply and demand of passes and rushing attempts and how that all interconnects, but where's the break-even point? What that suggests is that we haven't hit a break-even point in the two curves. Look at me talking about curves. We haven't hit a break-even point between passing and rushing where there's a mix of efficiency between the two.
Mm-hmm.
We need to hit that in the NFL.
Yeah, and here's another point that I think Floyd would even agree with as well, is when it comes to replacing offensive line, here's how valuable Jack Conklin is. Not only does he affect your running game and make your running game as good as it is by giving Derrick Henry some holes to run through, because trust me, people, it's not easy to create running lanes for a guy as big as Derrick Henry. Derrick Henry is a large,
you gotta
large
move
man.
Some dudes around the line.
One of my favorite quotes in football this past year was when Roger Saffold said, "We're like bouncers. We're bodyguards. We are paid to move grown men around like chess pieces, and that's exactly what this offensive line did.
Go watch those playoff games. They were moving the line of scrimmage 4 yards down the field. And what do we say about Derrick Henry? He lacks agility. Mm-hmm. If it's
he needs
not
a head of steam.
Yes, that's a perfect way to put it. He needs a head of steam because he's not agile enough to make those cuts at the line to get through tight spaces. There has to be the blocking in front of him. Why did he struggle his first 2 years in the NFL? Why wasn't he a featured back? Well, one, they had DeMarco Murray. But DeMarco Murray, in that second year they had DeMarco Murray, there was a way to overtake him because he wasn't the superstar he was the prior year.
And we talk about this offensive line just moving guys, moving whole units of defensive linemen, not just any defensive line units, the Patriots and the Ravens.
Two of the best run defenses in the NFL.
Moved them around like they were just rearranging furniture in your apartment. It was absolutely insane, and it gave Derrick Henry a lot of these rushing lanes that he had to run through. So not only
and Derrick Henry, we want to put it out there, made the most of those
and broke a lot of tackles.
He broke
once he
a
got
ton
past
of
those.
Tackles. He is the most difficult running back to tackle past the second level, and at the second level and beyond.
And we're not attributing all of Derrick Henry's success to the offensive line. They obviously go hand in hand. They feed off each other. But there is no Derrick Henry leading rushing season without this offensive line. And I promise you, even if you did were able to sign both sign Derrick Henry, not have Jack Conklin, you're not getting the same Derrick Henry.
There's also no Derrick Henry leading rushing season without Ryan Tannehill. Who's been on the Titans offense for the last 4 years? Derrick Henry. Mm-hmm. Who's been the Titans quarterback since week six? Ryan Tannehill. Which offense was significantly better? The one the previous 4 years?
Take a guess.
Or the one since week six of the season? The quarterback is the most important position on the field. I see a lot of people say Derrick Henry was the driving force of the offense, the backbone of the offense. No, he wasn't. What changed this offense was Ryan Tannehill's ability to have one of the most efficient seasons in the NFL. That was the backbone of the offense. It opened them up, and when they needed yards in critical situations, they got it from Ryan Tannehill every single time. They played on an incredibly slim margin, and somehow Tannehill always blew it open for them.
So we can agree that obviously Ryan Tannehill is the most important part of this team. So you bring him back, and obviously, and one last point, Tannehill helps a lot from the offensive line protection. When you invest in the offensive line, you're investing in protecting the quarterback and being able to run the ball regardless of who is in the backfield. But we come back, a little moving around today, but one of my favorite guests to have on any radio show, Tim Scarborough from Stadium. He is calling the game, or is the color commentator for Stadium TV, and he's going to be at North Texas today doing North Texas and Louisiana Tech. But he also does a little bit of color commentating for the basketball tournament, who uses the Elam ending, which America has been introduced to because of the NBA All-Star Game, and it's smashing success. We're going to talk to him, figure out what this whole Elam ending thing is all about, and is there a future of this in the sport of basketball. We'll be back with Tim on the other side. Calvin and Campbell, ESPN, 102.5 The Game. Welcome back in to Calvin and Campbell here on ESPN, 102.5 The Game. And our next guest, the man, Tim Scarborough. Me and Tim have had a lot of good basketball discussions. And like I mentioned before we went to break, Tim has a little bit of experience working with a thing called the Elam ending. We're going to get into that with him. First, I got to ask, Tim, how you doing today?
Hey, guys. What's up, Elijah? I'm doing well, man. How you guys doing?
Well, not too bad. Another good day here in Nashville. Loaded schedule.
A little chilly out here.
A little bit. Not too bad.
It's chilly down in Texas, too. I'm down in Denton for Louisiana Tech at North Texas, another Conference USA clash.
Oh, yeah. That should be a good one. The two teams close to the top of the CUSA standings, and I'll ask you about that here in a little bit, but we were talking about this in the first segment. Today is the 40th anniversary of the Miracle on Ice. Do you specifically have any memories, before we get into the goods here, about arguably the greatest upset in the history of sports?
I wasn't born. No, I'm just kidding. Hey,
you could have fooled me. You could have fooled me.
No, I remember that very well, actually, because this was before the onslaught of cable TV. And, like, even back then, the NBA was on, like, the finals that year were on tape delay. I'm from Philadelphia. The Sixers were in the finals in 1980. And we actually boycotted the Summer Olympics. So the Winter Olympics was like the big thing. Mm-hmm. But you had to wait before they showed the game. So it wasn't like you could get a spoiler on Twitter or something. Again, none of that stuff existed. So it happened hours before everybody here in America actually saw it. So, but it was a great experience. And back then, it was kind of like when Mike Tyson was in his prime, nobody thought they could beat him. The Russian hockey team was kind of like that. No one ever dreamed that anybody would beat that team, let alone the United States, who really hadn't fielded a good hockey team in many years. You know, the Canadians were pretty much dominating the NHL, and they kind of still do, I guess. But, it was an incredible experience.
Yeah.
Remember well.
Yeah, me and Calvin were talking in that first segment, too. Obviously, we're 90s babies, and we said if we could go back to see any sporting event, if we had a time machine and got to back and see any sporting event, that it would definitely be the Miracle on Ice. But another close one.
Like,
for sure.
No. I'm going to tell you what you see. I'm a college basketball aficionado.
Okay.
So, Magic versus Bird, 1979, the year before.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I think you guys should go back and see.
Do you have any, I guess, fond memories watching that one, too? I mean, I can't imagine going back and watching those two. Obviously, two of the best players ever played the game in college.
Unbelievable. And back then, you had to follow everything through Sports Illustrated. So I was kind of following Larry Bird, reading the articles about him. Really hadn't seen him play, just reading how good he was.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the Final Four, I got to see him. I was like, oh, my gosh, this dude is incredible. And then less than a year later, he got picked up by the Celtics. My worst nightmare. But Larry Bird was special. But Magic had Greg Kelcer with him, who was equally as good. Larry Bird didn't have a Scottie Pippen, if you will. He didn't have any second fiddle guy, and Magic did, and that's why Michigan State won that game. But yeah, that was kind of revolutionary, a great moment in sports for sure.
That is, yeah. We might not ever, you know, get something like that again. Two of the best players in the college game going at it like that,
and then they become what they became.
That. Exactly, yeah. And then fulfilling all of that at the next level. But speaking of the next level,
and getting to the finals, I think they played against each other like five times in the finals in the '80s. So
goodness, right.
Yeah, that's an incredible personal rivalry that obviously got the NBA where it is right now. And well, there's some personal rivalries in the NBA now, but nothing to that degree. But we saw, I guess, maybe some flashes of that competitiveness here in the NBA All-Star Game, which we never get. We had guys arguing over foul calls.
They cared.
In the NBA All-Star Game. Guys cared. They played defense. They cared. And I want to attribute a lot of that.
Yeah. How about Kyle Lowry taking charges?
Right. Yeah. He took like two, and he attempted to take another one. Like, we never see that. That just doesn't happen in All-Star games. Guys give up dunks. Guys are supposed to just pull up from the logo out of boredom in All-Star games. Like, this just doesn't happen. But I feel like a lot of that has to be attributed to the way the game was set up. They did, not a traditional Elam ending, I would say, but a twist on the Elam ending where in the fourth quarter they added, you know, to honor Kobe Bryant, the 24 points to the leading team score, and that created a target score for a team to reach. And I wanted to get your take on that for the All-Star game, like how it worked.
Yeah, and obviously I have Elam ending credentials like no other, I would think. I literally called the first Elam ending game in Philadelphia, actually. TBT, it was a jamboree. It was kind of a play-in tournament to see who was going to make it to the TBT. And this was just a few years ago. And, I got to do that first game, not realizing that it was going to be such a historic moment. And at the time, I remember thinking, you know, this is kind of loony. What are we doing, right? By the end of the day, I was sold, though. I saw how the drama of the game was it's just inherent by making the game that way, because it does several things. Number one, no one ever clears their bench, because even no matter how big your lead is, you still need that last however many points the target score is, so you keep your starters in. Secondly, the team that's trailing doesn't have to stop a clock because there is no clock, so they don't foul. So they just keep playing basketball. And the team that's leading doesn't run the clock out and dribble, and try to stall. They keep playing basketball. So that's the thing I like the most about it, the continuity of the game. And then you start thinking about the All-Star game, you know, they had a lot at stake because the team that was trailing was LeBron and Kawhi's team. They were trailing by 9. And normally, in most even ending scenarios I've seen, the team that's trailing rarely comes back because, you know, obviously they're up against it and need more possessions. But it was just a great thing. I'm happy the NBA implemented the whole scenario. I'm really happy for my guy, Nick Elam, the guy who invented it all. And I'll tell you a quick funny story about Nick Elam. Last summer, I know you guys probably know, but Chris Paul is a huge Elam ending guy. He's a huge TBT guy. He's a big reason why the NBA did this. He went to Adam Silver and said, hey, let's do this for the All-Star game. And the 24 made perfect sense with the tragedy of Kobe Bryant and his daughter. So with that in mind, they said, hey, let's try it. And Chris Paul, I mean, this guy is – let me tell you how big of a fan Chris Paul is to the TBT. When I met him last summer in Chicago during the finals, he wasn't – team wasn't in it, but he showed up for it anyway because he just loves it so much. And I walk up to him and I go, hey, I'm – he said, hey, Tim, what's going on? I'm like, how do you know me? He said, I've watched every TBT game. He said, you do a great job. I'm like, Chris Paul knows me because of the Elam ending in TBT.
Oh, so, wow.
That's cool.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
That alone is cool enough, yeah.
Right. And he is a great ambassador for not just the game of basketball, but specifically for TBT and the Elam ending. And honestly, guys, 2 years ago I said, you know, within 20, 25 years, this could change the game of basketball. I think what happened on Sunday has accelerated that timeline. I could see this being implemented in some shape or form on a pretty regular basis at all levels of basketball in the next 10 to 15 years.
So I'm curious, because usually, obviously, there's never a uniform agreement. So is there a group of people out there who are very apprehensive about the Elam ending, and kind of what's their point of view on the other side of this coin?
Yeah, so obviously I talk to a lot of people about it and get their opinions. I will say this. Most of the people who are against it have never really watched it or have never really given it a chance. But once you get it, you don't go back. It's kind of like, you know, you once you understand all those things I just listed and how it changes the ending of most games, which was literally why Nick did what he did, because he was tired of watching garbage basketball in the last 2 minutes. You know, basketball is great when the score is tied or it's a 2-3-point game, but most games don't come down to just one or two possessions. I should say most, but a lot of games don't come down to one or two possessions, right? So in those games, it's always kind of an anticlimactic ending. So he wanted to put the drama back into all games, and he kind of developed that. He's a Mensa member, a really smart guy, professor, he just wanted to clean up the game. So I think the people who are against it really haven't given it a chance. Most of the guys at TBT that play now, in the first year, some guys literally came into the game not even knowing that the game ended that way. So they were shocked. But, you know, the second year, you started to see coaches develop strategy approaching the Elam ending. In other words, you wanted to make sure you had a lead going before they turned that clock off, so you have a less of a hill to climb. So you started seeing guys maybe not fouling, but at least trying to get 2-for-1s or three for two, you know, try to speed the game up to catch up a little bit if they were down, knowing that that clock was going to stop. So, I would say ignorance is the most pushback that I've heard. Once people give it a chance, they usually are pretty much on board.
Oh, for sure. I knew I was sold when I first saw a TBT game in which it was implemented, and it's always fascinated me since then. But then seeing it in the All-Star game, especially with NBA caliber players on that stage, created a whole other level of drama that you just don't see in a lot of basketball games. But one thing that's gotten some complaints from some people, and I'll go ahead and preface it with this, it's certainly not me. I don't mind the game ending on one free throw to win it, but that's one of the only complaints. I don't want to say biggest, because it's not like there's a pool of complaints to choose from.
Right.
But
and Nick and I have talked about that too. In fact, the last TBT ended on a free throw by William Buford from Ohio State.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna tell you, he had 2 free throws to win it, and just like with Anthony the unibrow, at the end of that game, you know, he missed the first one and made the second one, but Buford had to make two of his, and he made them both. But Buford, those are the most dramatic free throws I've ever. If you think about it, he's shooting $2 million free throws.
Yeah.
$2 million from a free throw.
It's a lot on the line.
You know, so the drama was still there. And if he would have missed them, which obviously people do, it would have kept the game on, and it would have kept the door open for that Marquette team. But he sealed it at the free throw line, and it was still a big celebration. But I talked to Nick about that. It's kind of like, you know, you're not going to get 100% perfect ending. But still, it's still drama, even with the free throw. But obviously, you don't want to end it on a free throw if you can't. If you can help it. But, you know, ending every game on a made basket, though, is still just a crazy scenario that sign me up for. I'm with it all day.
Yeah, that's what got me into it, was the notion that essentially every game is like a buzzer beater, as in terms of it just ending on that make. And one thing that I've always combated people with when they talk about, like on that play where Kyle Lowry takes down Anthony Davis, instead of giving him those free throws, they said, why don't you just take it up, you know, check it up at the top of the key, like pickup style.
But
my thing is, too, is wouldn't that have an unwanted side effect of fouling for the sake of not allowing an easy shot, knowing there is no repercussion of getting free throws that would eventually end the game?
Yes, and that's why I don't want to take out the free throw component, because that's exactly. Having played city ball in Philadelphia, I've been through many games where guys have done that, because you know there's no penalty for fouling. So if you got anywhere close to making that game winning shot, they just go to foul you and say check it up at the top. You know, so you're really kind of rewarding bad defense. So you really, you know, you'll have to live with some games ending on a free throw. But let me tell you, today some games end with the guy dribbling the ball out at half court.
Yeah.
Some games end with the guy handing the ball to the other team and saying, "Here, you take it out. We're up 20. No score layup." Some games end with guys stealing the ball when they shouldn't and going down and starting a brawl, like we saw with Kansas earlier this year. So,
oh yeah, that was a mess.
No games are going to end perfectly. So, you know, I think giving the Elam ending a chance, you know, I think it's really going to thrive. But I'm happy for my guy Nick Elam. Happy for TBT. Happy for Tim Scarborough.
Exactly. Yeah. Hey, Chris Paul knows your name. You're on a first name basis with Chris Paul.
Right. That's I got one more Chris Paul Elam ending story.
Oh, so, I want all of them.
Chris was in Chicago the last couple of days. You know, we were there for like 6-7 days. And he came in. And I didn't go to the gym this day. I feel so terrible because he put, I'll tell you some inside stories here. He put $500 on the floor, and then he had all the staff shoot a free throw contest. And and one guy won it, and he's like the richest guy in the building. But, you know, that goes. But I wasn't there for that, but I would have loved to win that $500 from Chris Paul. But another Chris Paul story with Nick Elam is Paul assumed that Nick Elam was some guy like James Naismith. And I introduced Chris Paul and Nick Elam. He's like, "What? What are you talking about?" I'm like, "This is the guy who invented the Elam ending." He's like, "Man, I thought that guy was some guy in basketball history or something." He's like, "You're Nick Elam?" He couldn't believe it. He just assumed he was some old guy that was dead long ago.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, because it's such a revolutionary idea. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. Tim, thanks for coming back on, man. I love having this discussion. I'm looking forward to seeing where the Elam ending progresses, and I hope to at least see it implemented in like the G League or in some, you know, parts of basketball, to where we can keep this little experiment going to the point where maybe it is the future of basketball, like I think it is. Thanks for taking some time with us.
It's certainly innovative, man. I hope we see it just like you just said. So we'll see.
Oh, you and me both. Thanks for joining us, Tim. It's been a pleasure, and have fun calling that game in Denton, Texas tonight.
Yes, sir. Have to shoot around right now. All right, Elijah. All right, Calvin. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Tim.
That was Tim Scarborough from Stadium TV, and he does some color commentary for the basketball tournament on ESPN.
He knows basketball, that's for sure.
That man is a basketball savant. I could talk hoops with Tim Scarborough all day long. But unfortunately, we can't, because we have an interesting discussion that we'll tease up on the other side. And we've swapped some segments around to get Calvin and Campbell Attorneys at Law. But we'll kind of tease you up for that a little bit here on the other side of Calvin and Campbell here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Thank you, Gus. Auburn football's not playing today. But Auburn basketball is, right after us, actually, here on 102.5 The Game. Tennessee at Auburn. Big game for Tennessee. Every game for now here on now is a big game for Tennessee because they are firmly outside of the bubble. But going back to our original discussion here on Calvin and Campbell, we were getting ready to talk about the most exciting discussions in sports, the NFL collective bargaining agreement.
It's kind of setting the Twitter world on fire a little bit. A lot of people are really split on this.
It is, yeah. And obviously there's two sides to these labor negotiations, and we'll get to that more so in the second hour of the show on Calvin and Campbell Sports.
10:30, Calvin and Campbell Sports Attorneys at Law.
I would say appointment television, but we are not television. It's appointment radio.
Yes.
Boom, boom. And you're not going to want to miss this one because there's a lot at hand here for the NFL. And obviously the stakes are you get an agreement or you're locking out and there is no football. So, Calvin, we have the sheet in front of us, which is kind of like the full term sheet or an overview of the proposed CBA that the players voted or the player representatives voted 6-5 against. So this is the one that got scrapped. Calvin, your key takeaway is just from reading this sheet here.
Yeah, so basically, obviously, if you haven't heard, there's this proposal for 17 games and making the preseason shorter and a lot of kind of changes along a few like nitpicky lines in basically the laws of how all of this would go down. But obviously the big thing is 17 games, the extra playoff team, like you've probably heard about the headlines. And I think the crux of all of it comes from the fact that the players would not be receiving a larger chunk of revenue. Rather, they'd just continue essentially making the same chunk of revenue for the extra regular season game. So they'd be getting more money, but it wouldn't be a larger proportion of the money. And that's the difference, and I think the crux of the argument a lot of people are having is that football is such a violent game. Like, you're going out there and you're essentially sacrificing part of your life.
Oh, yeah, your brain's a big part of your life.
Your brain is a very large part of your life. We're still learning a lot about the effect of concussions on your daily life in your 40s, in your 50s, in your post-football playing career, and obviously the injury risks are there. So the argument is, well, they're endangering themselves for an extra game. So they should get a larger portion of the revenue as the games they play increases because they accumulate more risk. And the other side of that is, well, there's not really much precedent for this. It's that it's their job. They will get paid through proportion of what they have always made, and they will just get the extra money on top of what they've already made, and they won't get this kind of exponentially growing curve as, or maybe even linearly growing curve of revenue as they play more games, because there's not particularly a great reason for you to be gaining a greater percentage. Rather, you just get the more cumulative money on top of the games you're playing.
And another thing, we can go through the bullet points of stuff that has been proposed, but an interesting one for me is one thing that's interesting that the owners are succeeding is marijuana. That's been a big topic in the NFL as opposed to
baseball has announced
opioids.
They will be definitely lowering their testing of marijuana.
And what I don't know the specifics of the marijuana proposed policy. From my understanding, is they're taking it off the banned substance
in
list.
Baseball,
in both baseball and NFL.
So for the NFL, the changes to the drug policy under this current one that's being proposed, the new CBA narrows the testing window of THC from 4 months to 2 weeks at the start of training camp, reduces the penalties to players who test positive for THC, eliminating any game suspensions strictly for positive tests. Reduces the number of players subjected to testing for THC, increases the limit from 35 to 150 that's tested by a nanogram. That's kind of details. Right to be paid over a 34-week pay period versus 17 weeks, and new workers' comp that is past the drug policy.
Huh. That's an interesting one, that they're no longer going to suspend games, hashtag free Josh Gordon.
I think Josh Gordon might have other things he's got to do.
He might have
with,
other
though.
Things, yeah. And maybe one relates
also,
to the other.
This won't fix the Greg Robinson issue of trying to go across Texas with 157 pounds.
That's heavier than
Merrill.
You, dude.
I am a solid 150 soaking wet.
That is heavier than you. That is like if you were made of nothing but marijuana, Greg Robinson tried to put you in his trunk and take you across the border.
I can't believe that is insane. An NFL offensive lineman. The street value of this stuff was between like $300,000 and $600,000 in his trunk of his car.
Why does he need? Oh, I think he might have been in trouble with some people you don't want to be in trouble with. If you are an NFL offensive lineman who has recently received a pretty solid paycheck from the NFL and has been getting paid his entire career because of his draft,
it makes
status.
You concerned for him.
Yeah,
that what he's running around with, because it is completely one thing to get caught with an ounce or something in the back of your car.
Yeah.
It's a completely different thing to be caught with 157 pounds. You're not smoking that.
No, you're not smoking a Calvin Smith worth of marijuana that you have in the
Calvin
trunk
Smith
of your car.
And then three bricks.
That's amazing. Well, coming up next here on Calvin and Campbell, we're going to say something. We're going to say something more than Greg Robinson being able to fit an amount of marijuana that is as heavy as Calvin Smith in the trunk of his car is impressive and concerning. But we're going to say something that revolves around the world of sports or involves sports. We're going to say something in our favorite Christopher Russo-fueled segment here on the other side of Calvin and Campbell on ESPN 102.5 The Game.